This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize, maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Hello and welcome to the Peja Stojaković episode of the Hoop Theory Podcast, aka episode 116, which is in honor of him being one of the best players to ever wear the jersey number 16. Recording this one on the afternoon of Sunday, June 1st in the year of our Lord 2025. My name is Logan Wortman, and once again, for the third time in a row, and I believe the fourth in the last five episodes, I'm actually not joined by my co-host in Jacob Roth. His technical difficulties, I guess, have extended to now. You know, last episode, I told you guys that he was without a computer at the time. The update on that is now he has a computer, but his mic is broken now. So he ordered a new one. And that is supposed to be coming sometime in June. So hopefully there's still some playoff basketball, so still some finals games slated to play after we get Jacob back in the fold. But until then, I'm just going to go through some more of those awards that I started last episode, maybe get through the rest today. I'm going to start off, though, talking about just some updates, so checking in on the playoffs, where things sit now. We've got the finals set. Both conference finals are officially over. The Pacers won in six games last night. But yeah, before I get into anything else, I will first ask everybody to be sure to hit us up on Patreon or buy me a coffee if you'd like to support us. And also thank you for listening. Those links, that's patreon.com/hooptheory and buymeacoffee.com/hooptheory. All of our links can also be found in the description of both the show and the episode, wherever you're watching or listening to this. We would also greatly appreciate it if you'd rate the show, leave a like or a comment. Of course, be sure to subscribe and follow the feed. And lastly, we would also love it if you'd send something into our mailbag for us to read and react to. Basketball related or otherwise, you can send those over to hooptheory.mailbag@gmail.com. And so without further ado, let's talk about the playoffs. Pacers won in Indy last night, game six, like I said before. Tyrese Haliburton and Pascal Siakam both popping off for huge games, and then some bench contribution from the Pacers as well, mainly in Thomas Bryant coming in and hitting three threes off the bench when he, you know, the story on him this whole playoffs has been them surviving the minutes when he's on the floor with how disastrous that backup center spot has been for Indiana because, you know, they're missing a couple guys, actually. James Wiseman would have been one of the options there, but I think the guy that they would usually go with and the most rock solid candidate as their backup center is normally Isaiah Jackson, but he's also injured. I believe he tore his ACL, but I'm not sure what his injury was. I don't remember exactly. But yeah, Thomas Bryant being able to come in and knock down those threes. And then, so as I was saying, him surviving his minutes as the backup has been a struggle for them. So then they started switching to Tony Bradley in the recent games. So and even another guy who I think they had on 10-day contracts just a few months ago. And then, so he got injured though last game. So I think that's three of their backup centers are hurt. And that leaves Thomas Bryant to have to, you know, make the most of his opportunity, which he definitely did last night. It's a good story too. You know, hometown hero, I guess you could say. He played at Indiana in college for the Hoosiers. I'm not sure where he's from, like, before that. But going back to game six, though, another big contributor was Andrew Nembhard, locking up Jalen Brunson, which that's another big, you know, plot twist, I feel like, of this series. Was coming into it, I remember last year, Nembhard struggling with Jalen Brunson, even though Nembhard is like one of the better, you know, defensive guards in the league. Jalen Brunson is just a really tough matchup for somebody who's not really strong, or at least really long. Like, and Andrew Nembhard is, he's longer than Brunson for sure, and taller than Brunson. He's probably like 6'4", with a little bit of a plus wingspan for sure. But, you know, nothing crazy, nothing like Asar Thompson, who's like 6'6", 6'7", with probably like close to a 7-foot wingspan, I would guess. Probably like 6'10 wingspan, at least, and with crazy athleticism. You know, somebody like that, who's like just perfect defender for Jalen Brunson, as far as a long wing. But Andrew Nembhard doesn't have, you know, the length or just like the strength or girth or whatever word you want to use. To, you know, handle Brunson when he gets to his spots and like around the elbows, or, you know, when he's snaking the pick and roll. You know how Brunson likes to play his normal areas, playing booty ball, some call it. So it's a tough spot to be in for slight guys, you know, who aren't super built to be able to withstand Brunson using his leverage to create angles and stuff when he's doing his work there. But so the plot twist that I'm getting at that happened this series was Andrew Nembhard figured out a loophole or a way around this, especially because Aaron Nesmith, who has been Indiana's best defensive option to put on Brunson, he hurt his ankle earlier in this series, just a couple of games ago. So then he was less, you know, effective against Brunson, and also you just don't want to play him as heavy of a minutes load in that situation. So then Nembhard had to step up and get more, you know, possessions guarding Brunson. And something that he changed about his approach was that he just started pressuring Brunson as far away from the basket as humanly possible. Like, he started just pressing up and using all of the physicality that they've allowed in the postseason, this season as well as other years. But I feel like this year especially, it's been a crazy difference between regular season whistle to playoff whistle, how much stuff they're letting go. And, you know, he's using that to his advantage, being able to just put, you know, bump him and swipe at him at every chance he gets, trying to knock the ball away. Even on like inbounds plays, just always just up in his business. And so he started doing that using the half court line as, you know, a second defender, essentially pressing him up against the half court line and the out of bounds, you know, sideline. And he was able to wreak havoc doing that. He got 6 steals in this game. I started to notice this shift in game 5. I don't know if somebody else could go back and look and see if, you know, started even earlier than that. But game 5 is, I noticed on a possession earlier in the game where Nembhard was on Brunson, because, you know, I like to watch that matchup to see how he fares. Just noticing how he was not even letting Brunson get to the spot where it becomes a problem for Nembhard, you know. He's just like making sure that he can do all of his damage before he gets to that spot. But yeah, so I thought that was an interesting detail and something that really came up big for the Pacers in this one to close this one out against the New York Knicks, who I just want to give, you know, a little bit of flowers to the Knicks for making it this far and just doing everything. You know, it's just wild that these were the teams we had in the Final Four, going based on, you know, how we kind of thought these playoffs would go, with the Cavs and the Celtics being the only two teams that anybody was taking seriously out east. And then a kind of like large minority of people, I don't even know if it's minority, a large section of people who weren't even taking the Cavs seriously. So that just left, you know, the Celtics as the only realistic team to come out of the east. And they ended up, you know, going out in the second round. And not even because of the, you know, the Tatum injury. It was, they kind of dug their hole again, before that for sure. But you could argue, you know, Porzingis' health was definitely a factor. But still, you know, that series was just went away that I was not expecting. A lot of people were not expecting. And the Knicks were able to also play with the Pacers in a way that, like, these first two games of this series, especially the first game, game one, that was like as sure of a win for the Knicks that you could possibly have, that ended up somehow not becoming a win because of those final 5 minutes that were just otherworldly. Something crazy happened that's never happened before. You know, it just completely broke win probability models, you know, at the end of that game. The Knicks, though, is just, you know, a great effort from them. Cat, I've seen some people starting to blame. I think it's just some section of Knicks fans that always want to have something to blame, you know, even though I think the majority of Knicks fans are just happy that they are back to this spot, you know, that they have a good team to cheer for. And it's a team that it's made it, you know, to a competitive conference finals. It's just kind of a crazy spot to be at for the Knicks. And it, I think a lot of fans are just, you know, very hyped and satisfied. I shouldn't say satisfied, but they're happy with being able to root for a team like that. But yeah, what I was saying though, Kat getting blamed for, and Jalen Brunson both getting blamed for being, you know, stiffs on defense. Like there's some validity to that, obviously, but their offense would be nowhere close to even making it even close to this point without those two, obviously. So, you know, it's a push and pull there. But Kat just having just the old Kat ways, like how he's just fouling in this just most ridiculous ways in the most ridiculous times. And also that report that got leaked from the Knicks, people around the Knicks, like players and coaches being frustrated with Karl-Anthony Towns during the playoffs and throughout the season because of defensive matchups or defensive schemes, rather game plans that he was not executing. People being confused at like why he seemed to not understand the game plan at any point, or, you know, just things that has always been a thing with Kat, like his biggest critics, you know, will often point at with him. The most frustrating parts about the Karl-Anthony Towns experience is just the ridiculous fouling and being out of position, just seemingly always on defense. You know, this is something that I've said ever since episode one of this podcast in 2021, I think, or 2022, somewhere in there. You know, Karl-Anthony Towns, I was doing the brain exercise of swapping Towns with Simmons because that was during Ben Simmons' holdout, you know, him asking for a trade. I thought that they should trade Towns for Simmons, like mostly on the Sixers side, obviously. That was something I was suggesting because at the time there was like this weird drama about Kat being unhappy in Minnesota because I don't remember who got traded, but something happened, or no, they got fired. The Minnesota president of basketball ops before Tim Connelly got fired out of nowhere right before the training camp started. And then Kat, you know, made this tweet that was like, what's going on, you know, like, or I think it was WTF. I think that was the tweet, you know, him showing some frustration or confusion. And so then people started talking about trade ideas for Kat. And I thought that, you know, swapping him and Simmons would be interesting and thought about Kat playing alongside Embiid. And this was before Towns ever really played alongside another center in the NBA. He was always looked at as like, that's the five, and he can't switch onto the perimeter, so therefore he has to play five. You can't play him at four since he can't switch. But that was something that was very early on with my, you know, theorizing, the reason why I called it hoop theory. And that was that Kat would be a actually viable four man and would actually provide more defensive value than he ever could as a five man, or that he does in that current role. But with the only condition being that he has a rim protector alongside him at the five. So if, you know, obviously if you're playing just like a stretch big who's not really a vertical rim protector or anything like that at the five, then he's still a problem defensively, obviously not being able to switch. And it makes stuff even worse when that five man who can't protect the rim also can't switch. That would be a mess. But if that five man is an elite rim protector that you can funnel things to, like, you know, rim protection is just this thing in the NBA that can make up for so much. That's the reason why rim protectors are always the guys that win Defensive Player of the Year almost every single year. That is because having a rim protector that provides you like a adequate defensive rating on plays when you're just funneling the ball to him at the rim, so he's blocking shots attempted at the rim, when that is like a viable defense, then obviously you don't need guys to be perimeter stoppers. You don't need guys that can stay in front and switch out on the perimeter as much. Obviously it helps. And you know, the Rudy Gobert paradox, like how in the playoffs he gets exposed because they built their entire roster with that idea that I just explained in mind, that they're like, we don't need perimeter defenders. We have Rudy Gobert. And it works in the regular season a lot of times because of, you know, it's like this game plan that ends up working where they funnel everything to Gobert. But once you get into the playoffs where a team can game plan against it in a way that, you know, they go five out, so Gobert has to guard a shooter, then Gobert is put in a position where he has to either give up a wide open corner three and go contest the layup or give up that wide open layup. So he has to make the decision there. And also, a lot of times when you're going five out, he's having to guard a guy on the offensive end that is faster for him, you know. And then, you know, he has to go switch out onto the perimeter and defend guards and everything. Like, so that's what made that game plan kind of crumble. And also the thing that made that even worse, and what is, I think, a big part to be placed on Rudy as the blame for that is, you would think like the counter would be, well, just aggressively punish that team for being small when they go five out by, you know, having Rudy like just dominate the offensive glass and score inside. And he was never really able to do that at a level that counteracted, you know, the thing that they were giving up on the other end. And that was why I picked the Lakers in that series this year against the Timberwolves. Was not expecting that game five where he all of a sudden did that. He absolutely punished them for being too small on the offensive end.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know, when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself, talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now, get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Yeah, anyways, going back to what I was saying, people used to think of Cat as you had to play him at the five because he was not a good perimeter defender. And his only thing that he could really provide on defense was okay rim protection. Obviously, it's not like the best thing because of how foul prone he is and whatnot. Like all those things factor into it. But just in a vacuum, his best defensive skill is being tall and long and athletic and put, you know, blocking a shot. And having a weak side rim protector also would really help when you're going against a team that is trying to do that Rudy Gobert treatment, the thing that I just explained earlier about going five out against Rudy Gobert on a team that the other four guys on Gobert's team are all not defenders that can't also protect the rim because they don't have any of those skills. But Cat at least has a weak side rim protection, so if you're pulling Embiid away from the rim, then at least you still have Cat on the weak side that can also, you know, come over. So it just gives you another layer of, you can't just like purely just game plan to take away the one rim protector and then that's it. Also, he's better on the perimeter, I think, than some people also viewed him before. Like, he's not like the absolute worst just moving side to side. It's mostly just the fouling and like being out of position in a lot of ways. Like, that's where his defensive deficiencies are, to be honest. But anyways, what I was getting at was this series having that starting lineup that Thibodeau started switching to later in this playoff run with starting Mitchell Robinson instead of Josh Hart. So he had the two bigs lineup. It was Robinson next to Karl-Anthony Towns. And if you don't know anything about Mitchell Robinson, he is a rim protector. That is like one of his main skills. So they, you know, they had that same kind of, I've just found it interesting that where Cat has found his actual most success as a winning player in this league now has been in the exact role that I was suggesting that he would be in, you know, in a new situation in Philadelphia. I think that's enough of me just rambling about the Pacers and Knicks series, at least on the Knicks side. Let's look at the Pacers a little bit more. So one thing that I did write down that I wanted to touch on was the Larry Bird Trophy, the Eastern Conference Finals MVP, which I'm a big fan of, both of these, the Western Conference and Eastern Conference Finals MVPs, Magic Johnson Award being the trophy out in the West. You know, they, I think the first year they did it was 2022. And so I've loved that addition. I think they should have done it much longer ago, so we would have a longer history of it. But yeah, I'm a big fan of that, adding that as an award. to this postseason. And Pascal Siakam ended up winning it this year for the Indiana Pacers, which my first reaction was a little bit surprised. But, you know, the more I think about it, he's a perfectly fine choice for it. I think storyline-wise and everything, Halley's definitely storyline-wise. And just think about who's the face of this team and moving forward, like looking back, what you remember most about like this playoff run and whatnot, like having Halley as the name there would ring truer, you know, as time goes on, probably. But then also, if you just eliminate that as a factor, like the narrative factor, and just look at purely in these six games, who was the most effective Pacer? Obviously, Siakam is a good choice. I'm just saying that I think Halley is at least a comparable candidate. If not, I think it's fine for you to pick either one. I think there are a lot of people who would pick Halley and a lot of people that would pick Siakam, I guess is what I'm saying. That you can split hairs there to decide, you know, which one is the rightful winner of that award, just purely based off of what they did in the series. But yeah, so then when you tie in the narrative factor, I just really feel like it should have gone to Halley. Obviously, not the biggest deal in the world. It happened the same thing, or happened the same way, I should say, last year with Jaylen Brown winning it instead of Tatum, as well as the just finals MVP, the Bill Russell trophy. So I think this one is kind of similar to that, where, you know, you could argue Brown was the more impactful player because of he put up the better numbers, arguably, and whatnot. That is, I think, the case here as well. But something that I wanted to look at with this that I thought was interesting, just an idea I had, was how drastically different the caliber of player, or like the, you know, just the level of names that have won these awards now over the past 4 years. So that there's been four exactly now. Looking at the Western Conference Finals Magic Johnson Trophy, the Western Conference Finals MVP. In 2022, it was given to Steph Curry. In 2023, it was given to Nikola Jokic. 2024, Luka Doncic, and now 2025, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. So, you know, Steph, Jokic, Luka, and Shai, like literally four of the best players in the past decade, like guys that I've put up all-time seasons. Let's look at it this way. Steph and Jokic are both top 15, I think, solidified players of all time, which is really saying something. There's a lot of names to go in there. So I guess I shouldn't say solidified, but a lot of people, I think, would, without a doubt, put them top 15. And if they're not in the top 15 for some people, then it's so close. There's like only a few names until you get to theirs. And I think some people would say the same thing about the top 10 for these two guys. Just depends on where you want to put them. And so you got those guys, Steph and Jokic, and then Luka and Shai. Especially Luka, I think a guy that a lot of people view as somebody who's on that trajectory to get to at least the range that Steph and Jokic are, hopefully. And then SGA, another guy that I think if you were to draw, you know, people from the NBA that are in their primes right now, let's say, that have reached their primes and currently, you know, that still have a lot of time left, obviously, as well. So I'm just excluding Victor, I guess, from this because he's so young. But even if you want to add him, I guess. Like, if you want to pick guys from the league now who you think will end up there in like a draft format, if guys that could end up top 10, like who still have their careers left to get there. You know, they're not there yet, but they will get there eventually. I think Luka and Shai are two of the top three or four, at least, or at most, I guess I should say, picks. I think they're both above Tatum for most people. And then, yeah, I guess Wemby would be the other one. I apologize if I'm forgetting somebody, but I'm just trying to explain how great those four names are. It's just kind of a ridiculous standard. And then when you flip it and look at the other conference, I think it just paints the picture so well of how drastically different the level of competition has been in these two conferences in the past several years, really past couple decades for the most part, but especially these past few years, how just much better the West has been. When you look at the Eastern Conference Finals MVPs over the years, the first one, I think, being the best guy, the guy who's going to end up best all time, that's Jason Tatum in 2022, but he's still lower than all those other four guys I said before in the West. So, but that's the best guy here in the East. And then you got Jimmy Butler in 2023, Jaylen Brown in 2024, and Pascal Siakam 2025. Literally the last two guys are guys that are most people would agree are not even the best players on their team. So just kind of a crazy comparison there. But the other detail with this that I want to touch on was Halle stepping forward. I haven't seen anything like on Instagram, I guess, yet. So I don't know what like the people think, you know. I just saw an article that mentioned it. But yeah, I didn't think anything of it outside of like, I don't think he was all that mad about it. It didn't seem like he was. Halle just seems like the type of guy that's just going to be happy for his teammates. But also he has like crazy swagger through the roof, like crazy confidence about him all the time. And so he, in the clip, if you didn't like notice it, looking at the award ceremony that they did after the Eastern Conference Finals had completed, he's starting to kind of slowly walk forward a little bit out of the group of players standing behind Ernie Johnson was the TNT host for it. And so he starts announcing Eastern Conference Finals MVP. And before he gets to the name, Tyrese Haliburton is starting to step forward. And then he says Pascal Siakam, and he like stops and like kind of, you know, just takes a step back and immediately just, you know, starts cheering and rooting on his buddy, his guy, you know, his teammate. Didn't look sour or anything like that for sure. But I think some people, again, like I said, I haven't seen what anybody has said about it, but I would imagine people are probably clipping that and looking at it kind of like how the Celtics thing last year, they were like people were making some sort of deal about how Tatum didn't smile or something for Jaylen Brown when Jaylen Brown got awarded the Eastern Conference Finals MVP. I just feel like there's probably going to be a similar narrative, or has been a similar narrative to that, seeing as this happened last night. And things move that really quickly. And all that stuff probably happened on Twitter last night. But yeah, that will do it for checking in with the playoffs. I will move on now to get to the awards. But before we pick up where we left off, I did want to touch on one thing that I just forgot for some reason when I was going through it. The All-NBA, I did not look at the other vote-getters, the people who didn't make it on one of the three teams, but they end up getting votes. I did make a comment, I remember, about how there was very few of them. Like, I would think that there's usually more. I'm pretty sure there's usually more than 9 or whatever there are, but I didn't actually read them. And so to look at that, there's Alperen Şengün as the top vote getter who did not make it on a team, which he was on my third team when I made mine. I think he was my fifth name, so very last guy out of the 15. But he had 6 second team votes, 40 third team votes. He had 0 firsts. I don't think, yeah, nobody who didn't make it on any of them. Well, yeah, we know this for sure because the top 4 guys on the first team got 100 of the first team votes, all 100 of them. So there's not a lot of first team votes left over when Donovan Mitchell, who's the fifth guy, had 61. So that means there's 39 first team votes to go around to everybody else. And literally all of those 39 were spread across the second team and then one player on the third team, that being Cade Cunningham, with 6, actually. So he actually had more than 3 of the people on the second team. But moving on to the second player that did not make it on the third team, that being Jaren Jackson Jr., who was another guy that I had on my third team. I believe I had him 3rd on the third team. But he had 1 second team vote and 52 third team votes. But like I said last episode, Memphis fans should probably be very happy about that, because what it means for them building their team moving forward, you know, in the long term. Being able to keep Jaren Jackson Jr. on a much more reasonable deal than, you know, whatever, like $70+ million annually is what he would probably be up for if he made, you know, All-NBA team, which would make him eligible for a Supermax contract. And that also happened. I didn't mention this last episode, but the thing that I was saying the Memphis Grizzlies fans should be celebrating is the one thing that the Oklahoma City Thunder fans should not be celebrating, you know, should be sad about. It's kind of unfortunate. Jalen Williams sneaking in there on the third team as the 4th guy on the third team, making it so he's going to, you know, he's going to be up for a huge deal. It's just going to make it hard to keep him and Shea both on Supermax deals. You're going to be in the Celtics situation, you know, where they're trying to figure out what to do. That's why a lot of people are thinking they're going to trade Lu Dort this summer, mainly because they've got Cason Wallace behind him, and as well as Alex Caruso, guys that can, it's just insane. Like literally the best defender on the perimeter in the NBA, basically, you can say is like, we don't really need him, because if we don't have him, we have guys that can cover up like the same thing, do basically the same thing. And we won't miss him all that much compared to, you know, the contract that he's getting paid and being able to, you know, shed that salary there. So yeah, that's going to be something that will be interesting to see Sam Presti have to navigate moving forward. And let's really hope that for Thunder fans' sake that Chet Holmgren does not make All-NBA or win Defensive Player of the Year, because those are the two things that will get you onto a Supermax deal. Then moving on to the third name that didn't make it on the All-NBA teams, that is Ivica Zubats with 15 third-team votes. And then fourth guy is Darius Garland, who had 1 second-team vote and then 3 third-team votes, which is way less than I thought he would have. That's very surprising to me, to be honest. Like, he was like, I think he was on my fifth team, or my fourth team. I mean, like the first team after the three teams. Because last episode, if you didn't listen to it, I had that gimmick where I made, you know, additional teams for everything, which you'll hear more of this episode. And then fifth guy, Domantas Sabonis, with 4 third team votes. And then Pascal Siakam, same thing, 4 third team votes. Then Bam Adebayo, who had, this is interesting, only 1 second team vote and 0 third team votes, which is a little different. And then Trae Young was the next guy with 3 third team votes. And then that leaves Devin Booker as the last name on here with 2 third team votes, which all of those made sense. I believe I had, actually, no. Okay. I had everybody here on one of my 6 teams, but I don't believe I had Bam. I don't think I even had Bam on my 6th team All-NBA. I want to say, because I'm pretty sure Tyler Hero was my number one name on my 6th team. I think Bam was in my honorable mentions. He would have been like literally the next guy up, basically. But yeah, so he didn't even make it on my 6th team, and somebody voted him on the 2nd team. That was his only vote. Oh yeah, actually I can look at that right here. Okay, I forgot I have my notes. Yeah, so he was the 2nd name I have in my honorable mentions, which I didn't really do the honorable mentions in order all that much. But yeah, he's probably around the 2nd guy that I would put in there, because Levine is the first name, Zach Levine, that I have in my honorable mentions.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. You know when you're really stressed or not feeling so great about your life or about yourself? Talking to someone who understands can really help. But who is that person? How do you find them? Where do you even start? Talkspace. Talkspace makes it easy to get the support you need. With Talkspace, you can go online, answer a few questions about your preferences, and be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, wherever you feel most at ease. If you're depressed, stressed, struggling with a relationship, or if you want some counseling for you and your partner, or just need a little extra one-on-one support, Talkspace is here for you. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance? No problem. Now get $80 off of your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
But yeah, that'll do it for the All-NBA voting. And if you want to hear my 6 teams, or my, you know, 4th, 5th, and 6th team, really, if you want to hear those, go listen to last episode. Then looking at MVP, which is the Jordan, Michael Jordan trophy. Obviously, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander was the winner with 71 of the 100 first place votes, 29 of the second. So he, all 100 were top two. Same with the guy in second, and that was Nikola Jokic, 29 first place votes and 71 second place votes. So I guess here's where I'll get into the Jokic versus Shai debate. There's so many fans who obviously, I think somewhat rightfully so, are outraged about Jokic not winning MVP. Makes total sense because of just the season that he had. 30-point triple-double is what he averaged, and he did not win MVP, which is just a crazy thing to think about. Literally, without a doubt, the best season ever. Without a doubt, the best season by any player ever to not be given the MVP award. Do you know why that is the case? Because it's honestly, so it's close. You could throw it in there realistically in the discussion of just in general, the best seasons anyone's ever played. But somehow it did not win the MVP award. And that is because another season that will make it into that same conversation, especially when you're talking about guard seasons, that is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's 2025 NBA season. People are just, I hate how the narrative around Shai has become what it has become. How
so many people, like my friends, even like I'm the biggest Jokic fan in the world, literally. But I'm annoyed by the hate that SGA gets and how much it detracts from the beauty and like just entertainment factor of his game. Like how amazing of a player he is just gets detracted down to people like he's not Jokic. And then also people saying like, you know, he's a foul merchant, just like chalking that up as like his whole value is that like he just draws fouls and gets to the free throw line. He's just a grifter. It's just insane to me. I don't think the grifting is near as bad as people make it out to be quite honest. Even our co-host, my co-host here on the Hoop Theory podcast, Jacob Roth, is a big, you know, like Shea is a foul grifter. I honestly don't really think it's that. I think people, it's kind of like with Jokic. Jokic just gets fouled so often. He's so good at getting to where he wants to get to and doing what he wants to do on the offensive end that players are forced. They have no other choice really, but to resort to fouling him or like doing things that are like they're pushing the limits of what fouling is. And the difference between Jokic and SGA is SGA gets a lot of those calls and Jokic does not because of the size factor. So I don't think it's a thing that people are like, they like Shea more. And so they'll give him more fouls. It's just the reason why that is because it's a historical pattern we can look back out on. It's like the same thing with Shaq, how Shaq did not get a good whistle at all because he was a giant man. And the refs just looking at a much like a player half his size, the amount of contact that he was allowed to make on Shaq was just astronomical. Because if like, they don't really see it as affecting the player as much, you know? So it just makes sense. When you're watching it visually, you're watching a little guy guard Jokic. It's just, it doesn't look like as much of a foul as if you saw a player of the same size doing the same exact thing against Shea Gilgeous-Alexander, which they have to do a lot because of how good he is at getting into his spots. But obviously there is the foul grifting to an extent. I don't want to call it grifting because I think that implies that he's a fake star and that's like where he gets all of his value. Like some people like take it that far, but he is good at making players pay for being out of position with their arms and, you know, things like that. He's very good at that. Obviously there's a few plays that you can throw in there that are like, yeah, that's clearly should not have been a defensive foul, borderline an offensive foul, the way that he pushes off of him and stuff like that. There's plays like that for sure, but it's not as drastic or as common as people would lead you to believe. Every NBA player to a certain extent will, if somebody's arm is reaching over, if they're out of position, they're in a vulnerable position, the defensive player, by putting their arm out for whatever reason, any great scorer's initial reaction to that because of where we are in modern basketball would be to like kind of pull his arm over, both of his arms with the ball in his hands, rake, you know, his arms into that arm, which has gotten right into his path, you know, like kind of like the rip through type of thing that Kobe and Chris Paul utilized a lot. It's kind of like that, but just to a much more innocent extent because the player's overextending his arm right into his area. And so he's allowed to move his arms there if he wanted to, if he wanted to go up into a shot. It's just sometimes they are doing it when they wouldn't have otherwise gone up into a shot. Now they're going into the shot because they know that contact is going to be there, which I don't think is that egregious of, you know, drawing fouls. Not all foul drawing is the same to me. Some of it is completely manufactured and should not be utilized. And other times it's like the defender shouldn't have done that. And obviously if you put your hand there, you're probably going to get a foul called on you because the player is going to, you know, take advantage of you being in a vulnerable position. Just the season that the Thunder had this year, winning 68 games, and having the best point differential in NBA history, and then comparing that to the Nuggets having a pretty mediocre season as far as an MVP team, like the team that an MVP plays for, is concerned. You know, they only had 50 wins at the four seed in the Western Conference. It's just historically, it's like, how do you not give Shea the MVP there? But then also, I feel like you can ask that same question pretty validly on both sides. To be clear, my number one vote, my first place vote, would have gone to Nikola Jokic, full transparency. So in a way, I guess, yeah, I do disagree with who won. But at the same time, this is such a close race that I feel like there's such different cases too. It's like depending on what you are prioritizing or the way you want to view the award, whether or not it should, how much team success should factor into it, essentially, is what decides this argument. And I don't blame the people who take that as a super, super serious or super, super important factor, like one of the most important factors for this award. I think that's a valid way to view it. So anybody voting Shea is not like, I don't think that's crazy at all. Also, the other thing with this is, you know, Jokic has always been just dominating in advanced analytics and advanced stats the past like half decade, essentially, in the NBA. Nobody's come close to him in terms of the vast majority of advanced stats. But this year, like a good amount of them, actually, Shea is either right there with Jokic behind him, or he's actually ahead in first place in a lot of these metrics. I think Jokic still, if you map it all out, like count up all of them, I think Jokic probably wins more of them. But just the fact that that's a race there is just kind of crazy when that's been like one of Jokic's biggest kind of selling points for a lot of people of like why, you know, how great of a player, why he's as good as he is, essentially. Obviously, on a much better team, it's easier to have better numbers like that and look like a more efficient player. And Jokic was forced into a much crazier load than he's ever been forced into this season, having to play much more inefficiently, you could say, on the offensive end, but still able to put up the insane efficiency and output that he was able to this year. It's just wild to me that neither of these guys or one of these guys is going to walk away and has walked away from this NBA season without an MVP award. Part of me really, really actually did want, not even kidding on this, I really thought like months ago at this point when I first heard it thrown out, I think it was Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce on their podcast, which shout out to them. I believe they threw it out there as an idea to do a co-MVP award this season because the precedent being the rookie of the year once in NBA history, I believe, was a co-rookie of the year between Jason Kidd and, now I'm forgetting who the other guy was. Was it Grant Hill? Who is the co-rookie of the years? Was it Jason Kidd and Grant Hill? Yes, it was. Jason Kidd and Grant Hill, in fact, were the co-rookie of the years in 1995. So if any season, I think, deserved that, to have that again in the MVP award, this was that season, I believe. And so there we go on my, you know, Jokic versus Shea debate. Just wanted to give my thoughts on that. I've been kind of storing that up all season. There might be some more I get to about it if when I come back later and have more thoughts that I want to touch on that I forgot about, then I'll do that when I come back. But until then, I will be taking a break here before I come back at another time to finish out this episode, picking up where I left off, going through the MVP voting results. All right, I am back. It is actually the next day now, so it is June 2nd, technically. That always throws a wrench into things on how I'm going to make the timestamp or, like, you know, what I'm going to say in the description for what day this was recorded. But that's a me problem, not a you problem. My job now is to take us through the rest of the vote getters for the MVP award, the Michael Jordan trophy. I don't remember if I mentioned that in the last recording. But yeah, we just went over the Shea versus Jokic thing. I guess to just fully summarize that, or briefly summarize that, rather, I think that Shea is an amazing player. I would have voted Jokic for MVP, but it is not a war crime, I don't believe, like some people are acting like it is, for Shea to have won the MVP over Jokic this season, because of just how unbelievable of a season that Shea had this year. It's just understandable for somebody to want to vote him MVP, and he has the team success thing to go along with it. And I just don't like the detractors, the people that all just, you know, they think of Shea and they just think of, oh, he's a grifter, he's a foul baiter, he's, you know, not Jokic. Like, I just think that's all really unfair for somebody who should be one of the most exciting, talked about, fun to watch players in the NBA. Now, moving on to the guy who got third in the MVP voting, pretty definitively third. Actually, you know, there's a bit of a race between him and the guy at four compared to the drop off after that. But it's really just, you know, the top tier of Shea and Jokic, and then the next tier of these two guys. And then it drops off to one guy in his own tier,
and then it drops off once again after that. But Giannis Antetokounmpo is who got third with 88 third place votes, zero of the first and second place. Like I said before, Shea and Jokic got all of those. But Giannis had 9 fourth place votes and 3 fifth place votes, which I believe adds up to 100. Yes, so Giannis did get placed in the top 5 on all 100 ballots at the very least. And then Jason Tatum is the next guy. He got fourth. He did not get all 100 votes, but he was somewhat close. Looks like nine. Yeah, he was only one away. He had 99 of the 100 votes. So that would make him, which in all NBA, he got all 100 being in the top 5. So that's a little confusing. So that means that somebody put Jason Tatum. Yeah, with now how the all NBA is positionless, it's kind of weird that we even make them do an MVP vote when it's the same voters that do all NBA. Shouldn't you just take what I'm saying is the top 5 for the MVP should be exactly the same as the first team all NBA in theory, because there's not really different criteria there. It's just who's the best player or who's, you know, the most valuable player basically for that season, you know, for that body of work. So Tatum got 99 of the 100 votes to be in a top 5 for MVP, but he got 100 of the 100 votes to be in top 5 for all NBA. So somebody voted him all NBA first team, but did not put him top 5 MVP. So interesting take there from whoever did that. 11 third place votes is what Tatum got, 84 fourth place and 4 fifth place. And then the next guy after a drop off from Tatum at 311 total points down to 74 total points for the fifth place vote getter, and that is Donovan Mitchell with 1 third place vote, 3 fourth place, and 60 fifth place. And then LeBron James at 6th with 1 fourth place and 13 fifth place. And then Cade Cunningham at 7th, which I mentioned that last episode, actually. He was 7th, I did remember that correctly, with 1 fourth place vote and 9 fifth place. And then Anthony Edwards is the 8th guy with 2 fourth place and 6 fifth place. Then Steph Curry at 9 with only 2 fifth place votes. And then these last 3 guys to finish it all out all got 1 fifth place vote each. That is Jalen Brunson, James Harden, and Evan Mobley. Who Evan Mobley was one guy that I considered earlier this season when I was doing this as a thought experiment for being that 5th guy, honestly. So everything makes sense there. And like I said, my top 5 for MVP is the same as my All-NBA, because to me, that's the same question that you're looking at. And that is Jokic as number 1, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander as number 2, Giannis Antetokounmpo at 3, Jason Tatum at 4, and then the 5th place was the harder one because that top 4 is very solidified. But the 5th place I gave to Donovan Mitchell. Next guys up I thought of were Ant Edwards, Steph Curry, Evan Mobley, LeBron, and Cade. So everybody that got a vote. And then Brunson is literally the top guy on my third team. So that's everybody that got a vote except for James Harden. The one James Harden stray was one that I did not account for. But he ended up making third team All-NBA, James Harden did. I had him on somewhere. Okay, when I redid my notes to match who actually made the All-NBA teams, I moved it around, so I don't remember if he was the fourth team or the fifth team. I think he was the fourth team. Pretty sure I had James Harden on the fourth team for All-NBA. But yeah, there we go with that. That's the only real difference that I really have there.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at Rubrik.com. That's Rubrik.com.
And so that'll do it for the Jordan Trophy. On to the Olajuwon. That is the Defensive Player of the Year award. As well as the all-defense teams. We'll look at those as well in this segment. Starting off with the DPOY, Evan Mobley got first in that for the voting with 35 first-place votes, 32nd, 23rd. And then Dyson Daniels at second, 25, 17, 21. Draymond Green, with 15, 20, and 19. Lugens Dort at fourth with 11, 12, 18. And then Amen Thompson at fifth place with 9, 12, and 12. Ivica Zubats at sixth place with 4, 4, and 2. That's kind of interesting that more people put him first and second than put him third. But like a lot more people didn't even put him top three at all. And then Jaren Jackson Jr. had 1 second place vote with 6 third place votes. And he was the seventh vote getter, it looks like. Quick counting. Giannis Antetokounmpo ended up eighth. And he had 1 vote total. And it was a first place vote. He had 0 second and third place votes, which is it's kind of an interesting result. I don't think Giannis is a bad candidate for this at all, for like third place. You know, number one is a little wild. But Tumani Kamara is the next guy at ninth with 0 first place and then 1 of each of the second and third places. And then Bam Adebayo at 10 with 1 second place vote. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, which is the only name on here that just does not belong anywhere near a defense player of the year list, or, you know, all defense for that matter. Not to say he's like a bad defender by any means. I would actually call him a pretty good defender. It's just he's not like an elite defender like every other player on his team is, which actually makes it easier, you know, to be a good defensive player when you have just extremely skilled and strong defenders all around you. For the most part, you know, that does open up some things like if you're not a bad defender, but you're the clear weakest link out of everybody there, then you'll get, you know, attacked the most in switches and stuff. But having a back line of guys that like can fill up all the holes and rotate and recover and stomp out any fires, you know, with their skill in rotating and helping and everything. And you're all just so long and active, like it helps you put up a lot more better defensive statistics for sure when you're out there with those guys. So, but anyways, not to detract from Shea, like a lot of people do, but just on the defensive end, there's just a few NBA voters and writers every year that like toss out weird love to Shea for being one of the best defenders in basketball, which is just, I don't know where that comes from other than looking, just blindly looking at the steal and block category and thinking that's the only thing that defines defense. But anyways, yeah, he got a second place vote, 0 first, 0 third. And then Derek White with the same exact thing. And then Rudy Gobert is the last guy who got a vote, and his was just a lonesome third place vote. So yeah, all of those guys, reasonable picks other than the Shea one, like I said. And looking at how my list compared, my top five, I guess, or I guess I'll give my top three since that's how they vote for DPOY. My top three would have been Evan Mobley, Amen Thompson, and Draymond Green, which is a slightly different order than what we just looked at, because Draymond Green, well, that's actually the same. Draymond was third, but the guy who got second in real life was Dyson Daniels, who I actually had fifth, which top five is all like, it could go really any order for me, even number one. Like the guy who I have at fifth, Dyson Daniels, might as well be number one. Not even a joke. But yeah, so I had Amen Thompson at two instead of Dyson Daniels. And then looking at my first team, obviously you've got those three, Mobley, Amen, and Draymond. And then I've got Lu Dort at the fourth spot and Dyson Daniels at the fifth spot. And to compare that to the actual first team, we've got Evan Mobley, Dyson Daniels, Lugens Dort, Draymond Green, and Amen Thompson. So a slightly different order than the top five for Defensive Player of the Year, actually. Which this is a little bit more understandable since there's only three spots on the DPOY ballot instead of five, like for MVP. So it's not exactly the same as voting for defensive teams. But Draymond got fourth on all defensive votes, but he got third in Defense Player of the Year votes. Lugens Dort being the one that flip-flopped with him. And then Amen Thompson fifth both times, Evan Mobley first, and Dyson Daniels second both times as well. And then Ivica Zubats got the top spot on the second team, and he was sixth, I believe, in Defensive Player of the Year, which, yes, that is the case. Jaren Jackson Jr. was the next guy on the second team, and same thing for him. He was seventh. Giannis Antetokounmpo was the guy who got eighth, though, on Defensive Player of the Year, and he's not here on the second team at all. Jalen Williams is, though, at the eighth spot, or the third spot on the second team. Tumani Kamara at the fourth spot on the second team, and then Rudy Gobert rounds it out at the fifth spot. So it does break convention a little bit there, though. Tumani Kamara is the ninth spot, though, in Defensive Player of the Year as well. But then the 10th spot was Bam Adebayo. And Rudy Gobert was all the way down at 13, actually. But he actually ended up with the 10th most votes for all defense. And then other guys who received votes, we've got OG Anunoby as by far the top vote getter who did not make a team. And he was one that actually, I at one point was considering him for my first team. Oh yeah, I definitely was, because he's the top guy on my second team. Yeah, I literally have him sixth. So that was a bit of a surprise, actually, that OG did not make the second team, but he was close for sure. So he got 49 total points, and Gobert had, I guess, 65. So it was a little bit of a gap there, actually, more than I thought. But still, he had 2 first team votes and 45 second team votes. Gobert had 3 and 59. And then Bam Adebayo was the second guy who did not make a team, who is on here. 1 and 16 for him for the first and second team votes. And then Derek White is the next guy. Giannis Antetokounmpo shows up here as well. All of this makes sense so far until we get down to this next one, who is the fifth guy off. And that is, once again, Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And he actually, wow, he had some representation here. He had 1 first team vote and 10 second team votes. I'm surprised there's that many people that think that he's an all defensive player over literally like his teammate, Cason Wallace, who's much further down this list. That's just a little confusing to me. But Jaden McDaniels is the next guy on the guys who just missed the all defensive teams with 10 second team votes. Dylan Brooks is the next guy up with 2 first teams and 3 second teams. Jarrett Allen with 4 second teams. Anthony Edwards is in a 4-way tie here with all the guys who got 3 second team votes. The other guys being Brooke Lopez, Miles Turner, and Cason Wallace, as I previously mentioned. And the last two guys who received votes both got just 1 second team vote each, and that was Jalen Duren and Josh Hart. So yeah, all these guys I considered, other than Miles Turner and Brooke Lopez, did not really consider them all that much, I don't believe. Yeah, and then Shai, obviously. Like, I've already said that a billion times at this point. But looking at my teams, though, for my second team, I had OG, Tumani Kamara, Triple J, Ivica Zubats, and Rudy Gobert. So pretty similar, just OG's the only one swapped out, and he was swapped out for Jalen Williams, to be exact, from the Oklahoma City Thunder, who I actually had as the second guy on my third team. So I had somebody over him there as well. But to give you my third and fourth teams that are based on who actually made the first and second, so I'll have to swap in OG and take Jalen Williams out as a candidate for my third and fourth teams. But so then doing that, I have OG as the top name on my third team, and then Jason Tatum as the next guy, who is actually the, you know, the top guy I had in my third team before. It's insane that he got literally no votes, 0 votes for all defense. That's just kind of wild to me. I think he's Boston's best defender, you could argue. Most important, like, he does the most different thing. He has the most wide-ranging role. He's the most versatile. And yeah, he just has a lot of impact on that. And it's kind of surprising that he doesn't get as much love for, like, in terms of like two-way guys, like a star on offense who is also great on defense. Usually you see Giannis, you know, get all that love, which he deserves. But then Shai is another guy that he gets love, like a lot of love for being a two-way player. But I'm not even saying he's not a two-way player, but there's like much better guys that are like, they're literally stars on both ends. Like Shai is not like he's not a game altering or like a, you know, just like this menace on the defensive end outside. Like, he has a couple good skills on the defensive end that he's really good at, which is blocking shots for a guard and getting steals on runouts. But like a lot of that, the reason why he's able to sell out for steals and like going into passing lanes is because of the insane shape-shifting monster of a defense that lies behind him. Like, it's just, I don't know. It's something that I just don't think people really think about quite the right way. Tatum, on the other end, is like an integral piece. Like, he's the reason Boston's defense is really good. They're not like an elite defense quite anymore. I mean, they border on that, I would say. I think they're a top 5-ish defense in the league. So I guess you call that elite. They're not very close, though. There's a clear separation between them and OKC, I guess is what I'm trying to say. But Tatum is like, Tatum's literally the piece, the centerpiece of their defense. So I don't get that quite as much. He's clearly, I think, a more impactful defensive player. Anyways, though, Bam Adebayo is the next guy on my third team as the third guy. And then Derek White, another Celtic to be represented on my third team. And then Jaden McDaniels. So all those guys did get some love in the voting. And then my fourth team has Giannis leading it off. So I have Tatum over Giannis for defense this season. To be quite honest, I mean, I don't know if I feel all that strongly about that take. Now that I'm thinking about that, I don't know if I really believe that all that much. I think that it should be close at least, but Giannis might be just over, like in a vacuum, the more impactful defender, but it's a close race for me. Tatum, I just thought, just did so many things for them this year that I thought he deserved more love, but we're splitting hairs here, I guess. Giannis, though, is my top guy on the fourth team. Dylan Brooks is the next guy. And then KCP, another guy who didn't get any votes this year for all defense. I have KCP as the third guy on my fourth team, mainly just because it's just crazy that there's no Orlando Magic representation in the all defensive candidates when they were literally, I think they finished, were they second? They were at least close to finishing second for defensive rating in the NBA this year. Let me check cleaning the glass on that really quick, which might not, it's not completely raw defensive rating. It filters out garbage time, but it's just, that's where I usually like to look for these types of things. Let's see here. Who had the second best defense in the league? Yeah, it was Orlando. Orlando finished with the second best defensive rating with 109.9, which was a 0.6 points per 100 ahead of the third best defense being the LA Clippers. So Boston, just for a fact check on that. Yeah, Boston is fifth. So they finished fifth this year in defense. But yeah, I just thought that somebody on the Magic had to be included. And also KCP, I think, is the clear like defensive specialist on their team, you know, out of all the guys there. Other than like Franz Wagner, I guess, but he didn't make the cut games-wise for game awards, you know. He was ineligible for the number of games. But even then, I think KCP is the slightly more, I don't know if I would say impactful or important, because I really value size on the defensive end. I think that's under-talked about. I shouldn't say under-talked. It's definitely talked about. Obviously, you know, like guys need to have size. But I think it's even more than you would think. Like the Nuggets a couple years ago when we had Bruce Brown, our lineup with Porter in there instead of Bruce Brown had actually a better defensive rating, like in a very big sample size. I think it wasn't just because like Porter's necessarily the better defender, but there's just a lot of value to defense that comes from just pure size that people don't really even think about sometimes. It's a bigger factor than I think people even think, how much you can make up for. Like even if you're a slow-footed big man who's like a defensive liabilities in some context, you can still provide a lot of good like defensive value when you're put in the right spots because of how big you are. And like, that's the thing that can be said more about big guys than small guys. There's less of those avenues for maintaining value on that end for smaller guys, if that all makes sense. But that is my fourth team, rather. Giannis, Dylan Brooks, KCP, Jared. Oh yeah, I didn't even say the rest of them. I stopped at KCP because I went into a whole little thing about him. Jared Allen, though, is the next guy I have from the Cavs, Cleveland Cavaliers. At the fourth spot on my fourth team. And then Josh Hart rounds out my list. So both of those guys were also guys that got votes for all defense. So nothing surprising there. And then for my all defensive honorable mentions, I had Jalen Duren, who was another guy who got a vote. And then Jaylen Brown, also from the Celtics. He's another two-way guy on that team. Drew Holiday would have been a guy that's close. I can't remember. I think he's ineligible, actually, now that I think about it. Maybe not, though. Now that I'm looking at my ineligible list, I don't see his name on here. But he might have been close to the line. But there's just some people, especially with all defense. Like, it doesn't come up near as much with All-NBA or MVP, because those players that are candidates for that, often you don't need to worry about them reaching 20 minutes like played in a game. But for guys that are defensive specialists, you know, a lot of times those are guys that you might bring off your bench, or some nights you might go for a different look if, you know, they're not as good of shooters or something like that. They just don't get as long of a leash in terms of their minutes. So them sliding under the 20-minute mark is a much more of a realistic danger
And it will happen sometimes. And then they won't end up with as many games played on the year for what qualifies as a game played in the awards eyes, I guess, because you need 65.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's RUBRIK.com.
Those. So there's some guys that I wanted to look at as victims of the rule. And yes, I actually do have Drew Holiday in here. He's just on the line of the header. So he's not down in the list with everybody else for some reason. I decided to do that. But Drew Holiday, the reason why I have him in where I have him is because he's kind of in between. So I had a list of guys who are just ineligible because of injuries. So they're guys that I don't really feel like they're victims of this new, you know, games rule. Because I felt like they just didn't play quite enough to qualify on most years, you know, because they didn't reach the very close to like the mark of games played that people would usually vote for people. That was Wembanyama, Asar Thompson, Alex Caruso, Anthony Davis, Jalen Suggs, Chet Holmgren, Isaiah Hartenstein, Daniel Gafford, Herb Jones, and Derek Lively II. So all those guys I felt like were definitely players that I would have looked at for my fourth team, third or fourth team, or even first and second. You know, especially for Victor Wembanyama, he would have been the favorite to win Defensive Player of the Year. And then all defensive ineligible. So I have Drew Holiday in between. And these are the guys that I thought were victims of the rule. So it was unfair that I felt like the season they just played, it's dumb that they're not allowed to make all defense. That's what I kind of thought of for this. Like, it's crazy that they played this number of games and this amount of minutes, but they still somehow missed the mark. So Drew Holiday, I have him in between since he didn't actually play 65 games total, but he was very close. He played 62 games at 30.6 minutes per game. But, you know, that only maths out to 62 total award games. So he missed the mark by 3 games. So you can't vote for Drew Holiday 2025, you know, as an all defensive player. But he's kind of, you know, in between, like I said. So these are the more egregious offenses, I guess you could say. And that was Chris Dunn as the top guy that I have. He played 74 games this season and played 24.1 minutes per game. But somehow, only 55 of those games, actually 53 of those games, he played over 20 minutes. The reason I have 55 games written down is because, like I explained last episode, the league counts 2 games total that are you've played at least 15 minutes in. So you can add in 2 more games if you've missed games missing the 20 minute mark, you know, in those games. Like if 2 of those were in between 15 and 20 minutes, then you can count those, but you can't count more than 2. It's very confusing. I probably shouldn't even add that in here because it probably just confuses people. But 55 award games is what he reached technically. And even though he played 74 with 24.1 minutes per game. So it's just crazy. You can't vote for Chris Dunn for defensive player or all defensive team, even though I feel like a lot of people would have. Like, he might have made a team, to be honest. I wouldn't have been surprised at all if he made second team. And then Najee Marshall is the next guy. Another guy that, I mean, I think this one is probably more of a borderline, like, probably was more of a candidate for my third and fourth team than he was for, like, the first or second. But he played 69 games with almost 28 minutes per game, 27.8. But that only got him 62 award games. And then Jonathan Isaac, this one is a little bit less egregious just because he didn't even average 20 minutes per game. But he played 71. He only averaged 15.4 minutes a game. But it only got him 13 eligible, you know, award games. So, definitely not as egregious of one, but is one that I want to throw out there because I feel like you should be at least allowed to vote for a guy like Jonathan Isaac who, yeah, he doesn't play a lot because he's like a zero on offense and the Magic need guys who shoot. Like, he probably would play a lot more on another team that had more shooting, but it's just Magic. The Magic are like literally the worst shooting team in the NBA. That's not even a hyperbole.
So they can't afford to just roll even more guys out there that don't bring anything in terms of adding space on the offensive end. But and they have enough defense as it is. So it's like Jonathan Isaac's a little bit redundant. But when he's out there, he's a menace, one of the best defensive wings who can switch 1 through 5 like in the entire league. And then Isaiah Stewart is another guy who came in off the bench, played less than 20 minutes, but very, very close. 19.9 minutes per game for him. 72 games played, but only 32 of those counted for the awards. Derek Jones Jr. is the next guy. This is back to ones I didn't really go into specific order on here. I'm starting to notice because these two last ones are actually more egregious than the past three have been, really. But yeah, like I said, that's Derek Jones Jr., who played the most games here at 77. So he literally only missed 5 games on the total season. He played 24.3 minutes per game. So even more than Chris Dunn in terms of games played and minutes. And he ended up just barely missing the line with only 63 award games. So that's the most egregious one here. Feels like he should be able to be voted for. There's just no way that should be a rule that Derek Jones Jr., the season he just had, should not be eligible for all defense. There's something just going wrong here, you know, if that's the case. And then that brings me to the last one, who is a similar thing. And I actually spoke too soon about the Derek Jones Jr. one, as when I said he played the most games out of these guys. This last guy actually did, Keon Ellis, with 80 games played. 80. And somehow he averaged more minutes per game than Derek Jones Jr., but ended up with less award games, probably because after the Fox trade and everything, he started playing a lot more, and also the coaching change. So before, he was playing barely any minutes at the beginning of the season, so he had a lot of games that didn't count because he didn't reach 20 minutes, obviously. But as the season went on, then he started playing a lot more in those games, so it brought his average up more, but he didn't end up with as many games that he played over 20. But yeah, 80 games played, 24.4 minutes per game, 56 award games is what it comes out to. But yeah, Keon Ellis, one of the best defensive backcourt players. Like I would have had him in here over, for sure, Josh Hart, probably Jared Allen also, and probably KCP, I would say. But that's where it's starting to get close. But I would probably have him in my top 4 teams, to be honest. But anyways, that'll do it for defense, that was actually both. I did both the defense player of the year and all defensive teams. So there we go. That was the Olajuwon trophy. Now on to the Auerbach trophy, named after Red Auerbach, of course. The coach of the year is the next one we'll look at. And this one I'm not doing teams for, obviously, because that would be weird. I don't even know how I would do that. Well, now that teams are positionless, it actually is much more of a one-to-one comparison. You actually could do that because like you don't need to think about who slots in where. But just didn't feel right to do it that way. So I just did a ranking. I gave my names that I felt like were worthy of being considered. I don't remember who's on the voting though. Let me look at that really quick. But I have 7 names written down. But I actually included more names than got votes. Because it's voted on kind of like Defensive Player of the Year, where it has 3 spots to vote for. But for some reason, a lot less people got voted for. So there's only 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 total names that people thought of, which is kind of interesting. And especially when the guy who got first place, he won the whole thing, didn't even get all 100 votes to be top 3. But then yet somehow there's only 6 names total that got one of the 3 votes. That's very confusing to me. I don't know how that works. Also, one of the 6 guys only had 5 votes total. He had 5 third place votes. Where are all these other votes going? It's just kind of confusing. The order of the voting, though, Kenny Atkinson got first, 59 first place votes, 33 seconds, and 7 thirds. JB Bickerstaff out of Detroit got second, so kind of funny there. Just flip-flopped. You know, he was the coach of the Cavs last year. And he got 31 first place, 44 seconds, and 18 thirds. Ime Udoka from Houston at third, 7 firsts, 13 seconds, and 39 thirds. And then Mark Daigneault at the 4th spot with 2, 7, and 10. And then Tyronn Lue at 5th with 1, 3, and 21. And then JJ Redick is the last guy who got votes. Like I said before, he got 5 third place votes. So I had all of those guys in that exact order, actually. No, I lied. I just lied. I had Mark Daigneault second and JB Bickerstaff I had fourth. So I flipped them around. I still had Ime Udoka third. I had Kenny Atkinson one, obviously the guy who won it. Ty Lue I had fifth, who was the fifth guy there. And I also had JJ Redick sixth. But the one name I wanted to throw in there as another guy just to consider that I thought like should have been on the fringes of at least of the discussion was Chauncey Billups in Portland, just because of how that team overperformed expectations this year and had just a fun culture that kind of started to develop there this year in Portland. I'm excited to see where that continues in the future. So yeah, that'll do it for the Auerbach Trophy Coach of the Year. Now on to the West Trophy, named after Jerry West, the clutch player of the year. This is one that, as the years have gone on since, it's not really been years, but as time has gone on since me and Jacob on an episode like over a year ago, at least, probably close to 2 years ago now, discussion we had on the pod, an argument where we argued about the importance of clutch player of the year. I still agree with my take on it from the standpoint of like being somebody who is a clutch player of the year candidate is like what's making him a candidate is more important or more valuable to a team than like sixth man of the year. Like, I still believe that. Just look at the candidates for each of those awards. It's clear what is the more impactful player. But I do kind of agree though that like I like sixth man as an award more, but I feel like that's a different discussion than the one we were having. But yeah, clutch player of the year is just an award that I almost am like when I first thought of the idea, I just thought it was like something we would need to get used to and it would start to grow on me. And I would be like, oh yeah, it's because I liked it in concept, I guess. But every year I'm just still like, when I look at it, I'm like, I don't even want to think about that. Like, why do I care? I want to think about the other awards. So I don't know what that is. It does feel a little arbitrary, like Jacob was saying, or like a little specific or gimmicky, you could say. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's fine. But I did agree with how it kind of turned out this year. I had Brunson as my top vote getter, and he ended up with the most amount of votes. So he won the award, obviously. That's how that works. 70 first place votes, 24 seconds, and 4 thirds. Jokic, though, got second. Nikola Jokic out of Denver, that guy. I don't know if you've heard of him. Those two were the top two vote getters by far, though, with 426 points and 312 points, respectively. But Jokic had 26 first place votes, 58 seconds, and 8 thirds. And then Anthony Edwards is after a big drop off there, down at third, with 2 first place votes, 5 seconds, 22 thirds. And then Trae Young with 0, 5, and 29. Then there's Steph Curry at, I guess this is the fifth spot now, with 1 first place vote, 3 seconds, 13 thirds. And then Darius Garland with 0, 0, 16. And then LeBron James at 7 with 1, 2, and 3, which is interesting. And then Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, which I'm very surprised did not get more votes. I guess it's just because they didn't play in as many clutch games this year, but still, he was like a very clutch bucket getter. I don't know. I felt like that was a little weird that he only got 2 second place votes and 2 third place votes. And then Donovan Mitchell got 1 second place vote and 0 of the other ones. And then Kyrie Irving, Tyrese Maxey, and Jason Tatum round out the list. All of them got 1 third place vote. So I don't think there's anything too crazy there, I guess. I don't even remember who I have on my... I didn't do any honorable mentions because, like I said, this is an auto award that I like to take that much of a deep dive into. But these are the guys I have on my teams, though. I have Brunson, Jokic, Ant, Steph, and Trey. So literally the same top 5 as the voting. Although I think I'm pretty sure I made this list before the voting came out. I don't think it was much time in between the two, but I'm pretty sure I did. Because I remember looking up the NBA's clutch stats and like sorting through that, looking at the top stat leaders, you know, in different categories for the final 5 minutes of games when games are within 5 points, is how they define the clutch stats. So I was taking a look at that, but I'm guessing that's what everybody else did too, though, is probably why it's so similar. And then Darius Garland. Yeah, so who I have on my second team, though, I have Tyrese Halliburton, who actually I don't think it was in here at all. Yeah, he didn't get a single vote. So there we go. There's my zag. I have Tyrese Halliburton as the top guy on my second team, which in playoffs, I think that's been that's reinforced that a lot. And then DeMar DeRozan, I have as the second guy. And did he get any votes? He did not. So I just spoke too soon about my list being exactly the same as what people voted for, because literally the top two guys on my second team didn't even get a single vote. This is where it starts to break down, though, because, yeah, the last three on my second team all did get votes. And that is Darius Garland as the third guy on my second team. And then I have Tyrese Maxey and Jason Tatum to round it all out, which those two guys are actually the very last place vote getters as well. But there we go for that. That is the Jerry West Clutch Player of the Year Award. All right, and so that will do it for today's episode. Just going to cut this one off here so we can have it be a reasonable length. And we're just going to save the rest of the awards, which includes the John Havlicek Trophy, which is the Sixth Man of the Year, as well as my made-up awards to go along with that, the first and second team all bench, and also all the rookie stuff. So the Wilt Chamberlain Trophy, Rookie of the Year, and all rookie teams, which actually do exist, but we will be adding the third and fourth team for that. So I'll go through all of that in the next solo episode that I record. I'm not sure if it'll be next episode or not. Like I said at the beginning, everything is a little bit up in the air. But yeah, I appreciate you guys listening to this one. Stay happy, stay healthy, and I will talk to you guys next time.